Hello, I'm Simon Wakeling, and welcome to this month's edition of Six Radio on 2MCE. Today's show is a special one, in that it's the 25th programme we've broadcast since our launch in September 2020. To mark this momentous quarter century of programmes focusing on Australian libraries and archives, we've decided to do something a little different. Although it's my voice you hear each month, Six Radio is very much a team effort. I work alongside three colleagues in the School of Information and Communication Studies at CSU, Associate Professor Mary Carroll, Dr. Jane Garner and Dr. Casey Garrison, and we got together a few weeks ago to reflect on the amazing people we've spoken to over the last 2.5 years. We've all pulled out some of our highlights, and over the next half an hour you'll hear from the four of us as we explain and introduce what we think are some of the best bits of Six Radio so far. To get us started, here's Casey.
I'm Casey Garrison. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Information and Communication Studies at Charles Sturt University. One of the first things that comes to mind when many people think of a library is story time. Being transported to fantastic places and listening to amazing stories as kids being read to by the librarian. School libraries are focused on serving youth, and public libraries also have a huge part in working with families and the youth in their communities. We have focused on how libraries help youth a lot in our Six Radio shows. One of my favorite shows addressed this topic from Life Day One in looking at early childhood literacy programs across Australia and events like the National Simultaneous Storytime, which is every May, so check it out at your local library next month. A critical takeaway from that show was the importance of reading aloud to our children, and our guests from the State Library Western Australia and State Library Queensland shared research from their libraries in this area.
For us here at Better Beginnings, we completely understand and believe that reading literally has the power to transform children's lives. We totally know through research that children who are read to consistently from birth have significantly better outcomes both at school and later in life than those children who don't. You know, developing that love of reading and having parents build home environments that are rich in those early literacy experiences support children to have, you know, a significant advantage when they walk through those school gates compared to those children who don't have or haven't had that exposure.
It is an established period of growth. You know, as soon as children are born, they come out ready to learn, and sharing books is a big part of developing those language skills. And it's also valuable time with your caregiver, your parent, or the person who's taking care of you, because sharing a story with a young child is also prioritising time with your child and really building that bond between you, so that that's something that they grow up accepting and appreciating and loving. Plus, stories have so many great words in them. We've got studies that say that you get 50% more rare words in picture books for children. And when you think about it, it's so true. Like, when was the last time you used the word giraffe in a conversation with somebody, or, you know, rumpus? And so in sharing picture books, we're not only giving them time with us, building those foundations for later learning, but also expanding the words that they understand and can use and will appreciate in later life.
Another show highlighting the way libraries support youth was during last year's Book Week, when we also celebrated the first Australian School Library Day and School Library Week in New Zealand, Aotearoa. That show focused on advocacy and why our kids must have well-sourced and properly staffed school libraries. Holly Godfrey, who leads the Students Need School Libraries Advocacy Group, explains three reasons why this is so important.
That the number one reason that advocacy is important for school libraries is because students need them. And it's not just because it's the name of our campaign, ha ha. You know, when we look ahead at what skills are being projected for the future workforce in the world, these are things that are deeply embedded in what school libraries do. So we're talking about critical and creative thinking. We're talking about knowledge of facts. We're talking about how to read for information and pull out the main idea. We're talking about how to use information ethically, how to decipher if something is trustworthy or not. These are exactly the things that young people need. And the fact of the matter is that most Australian children are not at a school where their school library is well resourced in terms of the staffing or the other resources that they might have, like physical books or digital books, for example. So that's number one, your kids need it. Number two, I think that advocacy is important because there's a deep misunderstanding about what school libraries are about. And that unfortunately extends to many educators now and school leaders, because when we look at it on a national picture, there are many people who have educators who have gone through their whole career without ever experiencing what a strong school library can and should be like. So they don't know what they don't know. And I say that with respect because these are my colleagues. But these misunderstandings and incorrect assumptions about what a modern school library should be like and can be like aren't there. And the third reason that advocacy is important for school libraries is that a lot of the work that a school library does is hidden. So that might mean rich metadata on the library catalog so that people can find things more easily. That might mean choosing books that are just perfect for the students that are at that school to get them excited about learning. Or it could mean something like, you know, when I sit down with a teacher and I'm, you know, we're crafting a really cool research assignment together and the students in that class get excited and have deep learning. Nobody saw that meeting that I had with that teacher except the teacher. But the outcomes for your kids are better. So advocacy is important to bring that into the spotlight.
Another important area we addressed in relation to youth was our show for the celebration of Social Science Week in 2021. That show also coincided with Banned Books Week, celebrated in the United States, and examined the social implications of censoring books for youth. One of my favorite quotes came from Australian youth author and publisher Mark McLeod and his thoughts on adding trigger warnings to books for youth.
The parents who want trigger warnings on books, where would we begin and where would we stop? We want to know exactly what we're getting, because we're afraid of something that might come as a surprise. As a parent and as an educator and as a reader, some of my best learning moments have been surprising. So I am completely opposed to the idea of trigger warnings on books in general. There are a few specific instances. Robert Cormier said quite truly, you cannot make a child read a book they're not ready to read. And Cormier was not just talking about language readiness. Cormier is talking about emotional readiness, all sorts of other things. We've tried to make children read books. The system is called exams. It's called assessment. And if the child doesn't want to read the book, they won't read the book. So that ought to be encouraging to us who are concerned about children's agency. Of course, there is a different set of values and concerns in the digital environment where children have a kind of authoritarian regime of commercial interests, kind of badgering them, harassing them with stuff which may be opposed to their values. That is a completely different scene from the one that people were growing up with in the 1980s. So we do have to encounter that, but that puts even more responsibility on librarians and teachers to strengthen children.
I like that concept of being surprised by what you read. University researcher Sue Kimmel furthered this idea of advocating youth agency and what they read and are exposed to.
Changes that we're seeing, these cultural changes that we're seeing that are both, I think, positive in the sense of increasing diversity, but also, you know, frightening in the sense of silencing or censoring or canceling certain voices or certain opinions. And that just always sort of, you know, being aware of both sides of that, I think it's going to be really important moving forward, and just sort of keeping our eye on who advocates for the child and young adult reader.
We have been lucky to chat with librarians, researchers, and educators across the world working with youth and libraries in a variety of areas, from helping the littlest patrons learn to read to making sure young adult patrons have access to collections with well-sourced materials and are equipped with the information literacy skills to grow as lifelong learners and lifelong readers.
Thanks, Casey. Over now to Jane Garner for her reflections on Six Radio so far.
I'm Jane Garner. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Information and Communication Studies. Through many of our past episodes, we've been able to highlight many of the ways that libraries support equity and fairness across their communities. In July and August of 2021, we ran two partnered episodes that we called Serving the Underserved. These episodes looked at the opportunities and challenges libraries face when working with diverse and often disadvantaged community members. In the August episode, we got to hear from Kylie Carlson, who is the Senior Coordinator of Community Engagement and Partnerships at Yarra Libraries in an inner city area of Melbourne, Victoria. Kylie was able to explain why libraries are often places where disadvantaged members of our community come to receive support and assistance.
If you think of a library where one of the last sort of safe, inclusive, free spaces that people can come, no matter what their background or their circumstances, they can come and exist in our spaces for free and use our services. And that's the beauty of libraries and what we provide. So, you know, you think about COVID and then the type of people that we were really concerned about and really actively engaged and served during the pandemic were those ones that needed internet. You know, they've got barriers to access anyway in their personal lives. If you're thinking about homeless community or if you're thinking about people that are experiencing domestic violence, sometimes the library is the only safe place for a mother to bring her child, but also research how to get out of her situation or get online and seek out the services they need or tap into our social worker and our wellness booth. So, you know, what happens to them when our doors close? They don't have that place to go anymore and they don't have access to information that they can't access when they're at home or in their other environments.
The physical spaces of public libraries play an important role in their communities and all of the various groups of people who use them. In one of our episodes, recorded in 2021, Dr. Yazdan Mansourian, an academic from the School of Information and Communication Studies, spoke about the importance of library spaces for communities.
Basically, public libraries provide a form of public space to facilitate different kinds of social activities and social connections between people and information resources. Public libraries bring people together and provide them with what we call a form of contemplative space where everyone can escape from everyday life anxieties and distractions. And as a result of that, the public libraries create social capital. And social capital is the outcome of coordination between different groups of people supported by social organization. And eventually it creates and develop trust within communities and among different communities. And in time of disaster and crisis, the social capital will help everyone to be more resilient. So public libraries play a much greater role than just providing information. Public libraries contribute in a wide variety of social activities, ranging from lifelong learning, connecting people, and creating creative communities, and also contribute in different kinds of well-being, especially social well-being.
When we think of libraries, we often think just of public libraries, but there are many other types of libraries. And many of these actively seek to support equity of access and a sharing of reading for everyone. Street libraries are a great example of this. In September 2022, we heard from Nick Lowe, the founder of Street Library Australia, about why people might use a street library as a way of contributing to their local community.
The kind of people that set up a street library, they're usually book lovers. We take that as read. But they also have a belief in self-directed self-generated community capital. So the thing about a street library is you don't really need any permission to do it. You can put this little box outside your house and it creates both a stopping point for your neighbours or for people walking down your street and an expression of this is what I think is important. And there's a certain kind of just total generosity about it. So I think it's people who want to do something by themselves, independent of, you know, another organisation, if you like, and express, you know, what's important to them by giving it away for free.
The last word on the role of libraries in the lives of people experiencing disadvantage goes to Kyla Carlson from the Yarra Libraries in Victoria, who was able to sum up the difference that libraries can make in the community.
When you work in this industry, and I believe very strongly in the difference, we make a difference in people's lives, either subtly or overtly, all the time.
Thanks, Jane. Mary Carroll has identified another theme that's come across strongly in our shows.
Six Radio touched not just on what we understand as the traditional library, but also in collections and libraries outside the mainstream. Many of our shows explored this area with a focus on the changing face of libraries, their use in the community, their purpose, and how society viewed them. Two shows in particular on independent libraries looked at libraries outside the mainstream, outside what we think of as our public or university libraries. And they focused our attention on a number of generations of activism, and I would call it library activism. Firstly, through the Queer Archives, which was established in the 1970s. And then through the Jessie Street National Women's Library, established in the 1980s, and later the Incendium Radical Library and the Melbourne Art Library, which was established in 2020 in the middle of lockdown. While their focus is different, they collect different materials for different groups of people and about different topics. Across those decades, there is, as Nick Henderson describes, something in their origins which ties them together, like a golden thread of independent grassroots thought about serving people and representing people outside the norms of society as they were at the time.
So when the Archives was founded, I guess we'd been founded out of this idea of being a movement archive. So the idea of the movement, as it was termed, or the gay movement, was really a broad kind of framing of what activism was at the time. So in 1978, when we were founded, the gay movement was 10 years old. It had come out of, I guess, a liberation movement along with women's liberation, Black Power. And it was, I guess, seen as being the activist side. So it was posters and flyers. It was newspaper clippings and documenting the heterosexual or straight community response to our activism. So it was really looking at that side of things. It was also books and publications. But I guess some of the idea of looking at what the other aspects of what an archive could be in terms of, say, personal papers and correspondence and the private lives of individuals, that perhaps wasn't such a strength at the beginning, but became much more significant as we progressed. And I guess as with many community archives, the material that we have collected now is really in all shapes, sizes and forms.
The need for them to be established was also around filling a void. And Nell Fraser describes very clearly how the Melbourne Art Library came out of her personal need and a feeling of disenfranchisement.
It started on a very personal level in that I went to my old university library and tried to borrow a book, and my borrowing card had suddenly stopped. And I was so kind of sad and taken aback by the idea that, or the realization that I could no longer access all of these art and design texts that I'd been relying on for years, and that going to the public library wasn't providing those resources I needed. So the first kind of thought or catalyst for creating this library was realizing that there are so many people who just, can't access specialized resources. It was, a lot of kind of questions and kind of discomfort around differing levels of access to specialised resources.
Also, the Incendium Radical Library came out of a need to establish a centre for that literature and schools of thought outside the mainstream. So, as Annalise Arfat describes, had a very particular purpose.
For us, I think getting to the root of something maybe means like figuring out the structures of this world and how it runs to try and change it and challenge it, because obviously there's a lot of things wrong or I mean, it's obvious to us, I guess, that there's a lot of things wrong with the world. And we want to understand that and challenge it. I think radical also in the sense that we, maybe the way that we run and the kind of things that we include in the library, we have a big focus on marginalized voices and voices that challenge and critique structures of power and domination. And I think also the way that we run the library and what we, how we kind of approach all the different aspects of the projects that we do. So trying to be accountable to when people have problems with us, or trying to be generous and not rush things or pay people properly, or we don't get paid ourselves, things like that.
These grassroots libraries also ensures that there is a representation of voices that are not often heard. And as Tilly describes, the need to be radical.
I mean, I think that we are a leftist library. So we, you know, there is a politic behind it that is particular, and the books that we have are particular. Like, we do have lots of fiction, but usually we won't have things that are just easily found in a public library. And we also have, you know, we've got a lot of zines and archival material that, again, wouldn't be found in public libraries, definitely from particular subcultures. And we have books that aren't available anywhere else in Australia in any public library, which is really cool, I think, or an addition, I think, to public libraries, but very particular addition.
These grassroots libraries are great examples of the continuing power. People see an access to knowledge through libraries and the importance given to preserving a community's history in both their identity, but also the power that they can hold in society. Despite this, their fate can be fickle and under threat. And at the time when we spoke to the Incendium Library, they were working out of a suitcase, but continued the work that they were doing. And today, with the change of hands of the Nicholas Building in Melbourne, the Melbourne Art Library also can no longer afford its rent, and its existence is fairly precarious. Yet these continue to be important to in representing the community as we see it.
Thanks, Mary. When I reflected on all the shows we've produced, one thing that stood out was the way our contributors have talked about the role and function of librarians themselves. We covered popular perceptions of this in our show on librarian stereotypes, which was a particularly fun show to edit because we were able to drop in clips of librarians in popular culture, like this one.
Can I help you?
I was looking for some, well, books. I'm new.
I'm Mr. Giles, the librarian.
That's the librarian Giles on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, of course. In that programme on librarian stereotypes, Bonnie Wildey, a reference archivist with the New South Wales State Archives, spoke about the status of the profession and how that links to the visibility of librarians.
We talk about it and we think about it a lot for a few reasons. And I think more recently, part of it potentially is linked to the reduced visibility of the library as space. So, you know, in terms of books being removed from the shelf, the library is now, you know, not a library, it's a learning centre. There's fewer physical librarians, say, on the ground and interacting. And there's a real call for, you know, embedded librarianship. And so where the building and the books and the physicality was once the thing that people recognised and interacted with, it's now actually the person, the librarian themselves, who has to represent what the library does and what it means and the significance, and really fight for this is why we need to keep it. And so having, you know, those, you know, dynamic personality and bright clothes and, you know, memorable, you know, what is memorable about that person? Oh, they wear great shoes, or they have that funky haircut, helps us to, I don't know, in a way, you know, what, replace the sandstone, replace the bindings? I'm not sure. But that does resonate with me, just, you know, even over my time in academic libraries where, you know, things just like easy authentication or being able to access through Google Scholar means that even the library interface disappears. So me having, you know, the bright personality that I can talk to people and students and lecturers in the corridors becomes that point of interaction.
I also always find it fascinating to hear about the day-to-day lives of librarians. A great example of this was in our recent programme on cataloguing, when Alyssa McCulloch of Deakin University described the process of cataloguing a new item for the collection.
Well, if I have a book in front of me, and the last thing I was doing before coming to record this was cataloguing some books, I I started by sort of drawing out what I guess you would call the core attributes of a book. So its title, for example, the author, the sole person who wrote it in that case, its publisher, where it was published and when, how many pages it's got, has it got any pictures, any illustrations, any maps, any other features, has it got a bibliography, does it have an index? Those sort of what we would call access points and more descriptive metadata, which is generally thought of as being fairly fixed and immutable. And then I came to drawing out and recording what the book was about, which we would call subject analysis. And this is the real meat of cataloguing. This is the particularly interesting part. And deciding what terminology I would use to describe this book, how I would ascertain the core subjects of it, and choosing how I would record that, because I can't just pick words out of thin air. Librarians typically use what we would call controlled vocabulary, so very set lists of words that have very defined, regimented meanings, and selecting words or strings of words from a list and applying them to this book. And this particular book was about Indigenous history, and so I have a multiple vocabularies to choose from. And one of those vocabularies is run by the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, or IATSIS, who are based in Canberra, who catalogue their collections from an Indigenous worldview. And the other list I had to choose from was curated by the Library of Congress. And the Library of Congress subject headings are in very wide use in the Anglophone library world. And these two sets of words looked at the same book very differently. Library of Congress subject headings would say, this book is about the history of Camperdown in Western Victoria. And it's about the settlement of Australia. It's about, you know, land settlement, that sort of thing. And the IATSIS vocabularies went, this book is about violent murders and poisonings and colonization and its deleterious effects. And both of these are right, but it's a question of going, which of these is most useful, which of these is most helpful, and which of them aligns most closely with what we as cataloguers want our catalogues to represent to a user. Do we want to say this book is just about the history of Camperdown without really mentioning the other things that happened in the 19th century? Or do we want to say this book is about, you know, murders, poisonings, genocide, etc.? And the book is really about all of those things. And so the skill of a cataloguer is selecting which very specific terms to use in order to bring out the full truth of a book, or truth or truths, plural, and represent that in a way that a user can access and understand.
An increasingly important role that librarians are taking on is in supporting their users in identifying and avoiding misinformation and disinformation, which, as we all know, are increasingly prevalent online. In our show last year on the future of information organisations, my colleague Dr. Kay Adone discussed how teacher librarians are working in this area.
A lot of these issues that we're facing at the moment with public information literacy levels probably comes back to the fact that people who are adults now weren't educated in a time when information literacy was considered in terms of how it is now. And it's really great to see that in New South Wales there's a new information fluency framework that's been launched across all of the New South Wales Department of Education schools that recognises that for so long we've taught information literacy in schools as being something about how to research for assessments and how to answer an inquiry question or an assessment task, but not necessarily introducing the idea of needing to be information literate or information fluent beyond academic scenarios. And so now that we're starting to talk about information fluency and realising that even from the very youngest age we can be introducing these concepts, hopefully as students grow and develop, hopefully if they've got a good teacher librarian supporting the teachers to do so, we won't necessarily have these same issues to this extent in the future.
That's all we have time for today, I'm afraid. We hope you've enjoyed hearing clips from some of our favourite Six Radio shows. We've got some exciting shows planned for the next few months, including looking at how libraries cater for culturally diverse communities and the current and future role of artificial intelligence. So until next month, happy borrowing.